Covering the Western Hockey League from south of the border, this is the U.S. Division Podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the U.S. Division Podcast. My name is Scott Sepich. You can listen to this and all of the other podcasts at theusdivision.com. You can also subscribe via iTunes. Go into the iTunes store, search for the U.S. Division, or for my name, Scott Sepich, and you should find among the search results the podcast, and then you can subscribe to it there. Every time I post a new episode, you will get it sent to you at your iTunes account. Today we'll be talking about the Portland Winterhawks. I will have Dylan Bumbarger of OregonLive.com joining me in a couple of minutes. We talk about a wide variety of topics, both about this season, about last season, and I do want to talk, before I bring Dylan on, a little bit about this year's team, because we don't get into some of the more basic stuff in our conversation, so I just wanted to bring up, discuss a few things heading into tonight's season opener between the Winterhawks and the Prince George Cougars. The last two seasons, and I can remember very clearly last year about this time, there were a lot of doubts about whether or not the Winterhawks could get back to the Western Hockey League Finals because of the quality of players that they were losing. You know, last summer we were talking about losing the Winterhawks, losing guys like Sven Berchi and Brad Ross, Joe Morrow and Marcel Nobles, Cam Reed, Oliver Gabriel, a lot of real top guys who helped the Winterhawks get to that to Game 7 of the WHL Finals a couple seasons ago. There were a lot of new faces last year, even though we knew Ty Ratty would be back. We knew Seth Jones would probably be really good, even though he was a new face. But there were expectations that it wasn't quite clear how this team was going to do. Of course, we also didn't know that Matt Carruth would be back to play goal. So, and yet, you know, not only did they get back to where they were before, but they, you know, even exceeded that and set new records for the franchise in victories and points and you know, other records like fewest goals allowed. So it ended up being, you know, certainly one of the top three or so seasons probably in franchise history, all things considered. That, of course, all happened at the same time that there were these very, very, you know, intense off-ice distractions with the sanctions situation and Mike Johnson having to sit out, you know, the rest of the year after November 28th. And at that point, the team was rolling, and nobody knew, you know, could the team keep that up? Were the distractions going to be too much? Travis Green, of course, stepped in. The team didn't miss a beat. So everything, you know, last year, given all of the distractions that happened and all of the intense scrutiny that was going on with the team, and certainly the emotions from opposing fans, you know, the team having to live with the brand of being labeled cheaters the rest of the season and having to overcome that, it was a pretty impressive feat that they were able to do what they did. Going into this season, I think that you're looking again at some very, very important losses. And but at the same time, you look at the roster and you look at the other rosters in the division and really in the league, the Winterhawks still have, even without guys like Ty Ratty, Seth Jones, Matt Carruth, Tyler Weatherspoon, Taylor Peters, Troy Rutkowski, these are the guys who are gone. And even without those guys, this team still has a ton of talent coming back, and that's why I think this year the expectations are there that this team is going to be back at the top of the conference, maybe in a race with Kelowna at the very top for that first seed in the conference, but this once again should be a team that's competing for a WHL title. And mostly the strength of this team is at forward, and you look at all of the returning players here, really of the top six forwards from last year's team, Ratty is the only one gone. Now, of course, Ratty is, I would argue, one of the best, if not the best, forward in the history of the team, given all the thing that everything that he accomplished in his four-plus seasons here. But you're still bringing back the co-leading scorers in the league in Brendan Leipzig and Nick Batan. You're also bringing back the entire second line, Oliver Bjorkstrand, Chase DeLeo, and Taylor Lear. All three of those guys look set to have another big season. And that doesn't even mention this group of 17-year-olds who got a lot of good experience last year. Paul Bittner, Keegan Iverson, Dominic Turgeon didn't play as much last year. He didn't play as big of a role, but he's expected to have a pretty big season once he gets back from an injury that he's battling right now. And then there are still some pretty good checking line type guys: Adam DeChamplain, Preston Kopech, Alex Schoenborn, who only played 20 games last year, is expected to make a step this year. And we haven't even talked about any rookies yet. So this is a team that's loaded with forwards who have experience at the WHL level, and it's probably going to create not a whole lot of opportunities for guys like Ethan Price, who's a 16-year-old, Steven Aldridge, who's a 17-year-old, a big kid who's coming in and has made the team, and then you have an overager, Adam Rossignol, who's here right now, who's got some experience playing up in Regina. And eventually, in October, we'll see Shane McColgan, who was acquired in a trade. He'll probably slide, we assume he'll slide under that top line with Leipzig and Patan. And it basically just shows you this, how deep this team is going to be on the front line when everybody is back and everybody's healthy. Of course, the question mark is on defense. That's a situation where you have really of the top four last year that was maybe the best top four defense group that this team's ever had. Three of those guys are gone. Derek Pouliot is still in Pittsburgh Penguins camp and will probably be there for at least a couple more weeks. So this team is relatively inexperienced, at least at the WHL level, outside of Josh Hansen, the 19-year-old from Alaska, who is in his fourth season with the team. But Hansen hasn't really had to have, play the biggest minutes on the team. He's always been a guy that's been in the third pairing, and he's always, last year was always the fifth defenseman. Not that he didn't get a lot of good playing time, but Hansen hasn't really had to, accept a huge role with the team. And going into the season right now with Pouliot out at camp, Hansen is the one guy who really has a lot of good WHL experience under his belt. And he's not an offensive type player. I think he has two career goals at this point in three seasons. So he's not a guy that's going to come in and be like a Pouliot or a Rakowski or Jones, and somebody who's going to be a dynamic offensive presence from the blue line. He's more of a stay at home guy. And you look at this team, outside of Pouliot, you don't see a whole lot of that offensive-style defenseman that we've been used to seeing here in the last few seasons. I'm not surprised that the Winterhawks went in and brought in some older players, even if they're new, to play, to help shore up the defense. And Garrett Haar, the 20-year-old who was attending Western Michigan, he's joining the team this year for his overage season. And then Anton Cederholm, an 18-year-old from Sweden, was selected in the import draft. Mike Johnson elected to release Kirill Vorobev, who played pretty well last year as a 17-year-old, but was never really never really quite considered, I think, a key piece going forward. And so Cederholm, being a Vancouver Canucks draft pick, was available. And this guy can come in right away and play some good minutes and shore things up. So between Hansen, Haar, Cederholm, we have 19-year-old Sean McPherson coming back here this year. He was brought in middle of the season last year and then stuck with the team and actually dressed for every Memorial Cup game, even though he didn't get a lot of shifts. But McPherson will be a big part of the defense. And then beyond that, you know, sort of a logjam of a few guys who will all be sort of competing for playing time. I think I've got the 18-year-old Lane Viveros, who's been here a couple of years but has never really been able to find regular playing time. Zach Patterson, a 17-year-old, had a cup of coffee here last year, but he's looking to get in the mix. And then 16-year-old Keone Teixeira is an exciting prospect. He might not be quite ready to play the big minutes. I think he's in the mold of more of a Pouliot type, an offensive style defenseman. So he'll be a lot of fun to watch him, even if he doesn't get a ton of opportunities early in the season. I mean, I guess we'll see how things play out. I've heard he's really good, and I know he played very well in training camp both last year and this year. So we'll see what Teixeira has to bring. And then you look at goaltender, and obviously Brendan Burke, you know, is the guy this year. And he got a lot of good experience last year as a backup to Matt Kerruth. Both Mike Johnston and Travis Green made sure that he got into a lot of games. He played 33 games last year. I put up decent numbers. He didn't play against, you know, the best teams. He was usually the goalie against, you know, Seattle and Everett. And he did play a lot against Tri-City, so he did get some opportunities there to play against, you know, good competition. And, you know, never really played back-to-back nights, which he might have to do this year. So it's definitely a new thing for Burke, but he seems very confident, seems like he's very ready to do it. All right, joining me now, he is a blogger for OregonLive.com in his seventh season writing about the Portland Winterhawks, Dylan Bumbarger. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I've been doing these previews generally with newspaper beat writers from around the division. We don't really have one of those in Portland. I'm the closest thing to it, I guess, for the newspaper end, but you have been doing a great job over the last few years covering the team, covering the Winterhawks through ups and downs, obviously on a major upswing right now. It was probably a little bit tough when you first started out writing about this team. How were you able to sort of stick through the bad times with this team?
Oh, well, it was tough. Especially since everything was going on off the ice and there were thoughts that they might move and all that stuff going on. But I just stuck with it. You know, you always hope that things could get better. And in this case, they did, and then some.
Yeah, and we've gotten to the point here in Portland where 5 years ago, nobody knew if the team would be here, what was going on. Now it's almost unreasonable expectations after three straight Western Conference championships that, you know, people are now expecting them to win every year, to be in the mix every year. That's kind of probably not possible going forward, that it's going to be quite this good indefinitely. But how does this team continue to live up these expectations, and what should be the expectations going forward, say, from now for the next 5 years? What's an acceptable or unacceptable trajectory for this team from now?
Well, first, I think you have to acknowledge what a special group to pass through. The group that just got here at the end of the bad spell, your Rutkowski and
Taylor Peters
especially, yeah. Ratty was just barely there at the beginning. What a special group that was, especially last year with all the pressure and people getting in their face about all the stuff that was going on and how they handled that amazingly. And it's important not to take them for granted and just how special they were. So, you know, you look at their 17-year-olds especially, and it's almost reasonable to expect them to contend every year for about the next five, and doesn't seem to be slowing down at all. I mean, you can't expect Mike Johnson to hit a home run every time, but so far he's done well.
Yeah, well, I talked to him today a little bit, actually, at practice, and, you know, when he came in, and even though he didn't make these picks, he had the benefit of having some guys who were picked really high in the Bannon draft, and he was able to pick Niederreiter high in the import draft and Pouliot with number one because of how bad the team had been. He doesn't have that luxury anymore, especially now that they don't even have first-round picks for the next few years.
Exactly.
So he has to be a little bit more creative. And like he said, he talked about finding, you know, diamonds in the rough and looking and maybe to more non-traditional places and things like that to kind of keep things going. But it's going to be hard. At some point, you would think that the lack of access to the very top tier will hurt this team somewhat going forward, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, but, they've done so well at picking up the U.S. players. I mean, almost to the point where the CHL might have to step in at some point and figure out a different way, because what they've been doing is drafting players who would be probably have a first, second-round talent and then drafting them fifth or sixth or seventh or some cases not even at all, just listing them and then convincing them to come here. And, I mean, that's – you figure at some point the Canadian junior hockey is going to step in and say, well, this really isn't the way we want to do that for competitive balance purposes. I mean, it goes against the whole point of the draft. So – and I don't really know the solution to that, but so far they've hit they've hit with just about everybody from the U.S. that they've picked.
Yeah, when you look at the 17-year-old group this year and you have, you know, the three that are kind of tied together, I guess, are Bittner, Iverson, and Turgeon, who are all going to go up together. And I believe, I have to go back and look, but was Iverson even drafted? I don't think he was. I think they just listed him and got him to come, and... I know Turgeon was drafted, but I don't think it was a high round. And same with Bittner. So just the fact that they, like you said, they're hitting on these guys, they're picking them late or not at all, getting them here, and then they turn out to be, you know, pretty decent high-end players for the league. But you can also find lots of examples of players that have been drafted late in the draft that have panned out all around the league. And guys like, you know, Ryan Johansson here or you know, being Brendan Leipzig here, guys like that. I did want to touch on the Memorial Cup last year, or actually, what, 3.5 months ago now. I think you and I had kind of the same take or have some of the same reservations about the format of the Memorial Cup. My opinion back then was, you know, winning your league is really the hard part. You have to go through the grind, the seven-game series, that whole thing. The Memorial Cup is kind of a crapshoot. We've seen inferior teams win it before. Does it matter, really, that Portland didn't win the Memorial Cup when all said and done? Is it more important that they won the league, and is that really the bigger accomplishment?
Oh, I think so. For me, always, the Memorial Cup was just going to be gravy. But on the other hand, you know, it was a crapshoot, but in the end, Halifax seemed to me to be clearly the better team, at least over the two games. Portland never could stop that top line. And, you know, maybe if they played a seven-game series, maybe they would have figured out eventually. But, you know, they got beat twice. So I can't really complain about the format this year. The format really wasn't a big issue. But, yeah, for me, it was always about the league.
Yeah, you can't. I guess you could see. This was an example of how it really worked out in a sense, because the three best teams in junior hockey all went there. I mean, all three teams that were the top of their league all year all won their leagues. And then they were the top three teams in the tournament as well. Saskatoon ended up finishing last in the competition. And then, like you said, Halifax had the opportunity to... They pretty much proved it. I mean, they won the first game against the Hawks. They had to win another one. And you know, like you said, Portland didn't have any answer for that top line. So this year, you could say pretty definitively the best team won, and probably the true second place team was the team that finished second. Whereas in the past, you know, look at Shawinigan 2 years ago, probably really like that. So, but it's.
Right. There have been some years where the format seems to have gotten in the way of actually crowning a champion, but I don't think you can say that this year.
So what were your impressions? You were watching the games on TV in May, the Sportsnet coverage. What were your impressions of how Sportsnet covered the Winterhawks and, I guess, the what were the good parts and what were the bad parts as you saw it?
Well, I didn't listen to Sportsnet coverage all that much. Most of the time I had the sound turned down and was listening to the Winterhawks broadcast. But the general impression I got was that it was Seth Jones against Nathan MacKinnon. And it seemed like that was how they covered it. And that was a little unfair, I think. I think it's always going to be unfair to the defenseman when you're making a comparison like that. And you know, the whole... Winterhawk defense never really could stop him or Drouin, and I think Seth took a little too much heat for that, and it probably hurt him in the draft. The other thing I remember from the coverage was it was just so long. I mean, NHL games were like 2.5 hours, and it seemed like this was all really drawn out, and I don't know if it was more commercials or what, or just the pace seemed so much slower.
Well, there were... A lot of TV timeouts.
Yeah.
And which is interesting because that changed the whole strategy of how you could play the game, because knowing that you were going to get these 2 minute breaks three times a period, you basically only had to use four defensemen, which is what Portland did most of the time. But you're right as far as when you're talking about Seth Jones versus Nathan MacKinnon. That's exactly the impression I got from being there and being in the middle of all of the media scrums. When the Winterhawks would come out of their locker room to talk after games or in the morning of media availabilities, Seth would emerge and like 30 people would just descend upon him immediately. And a lot of times Ty Ratty would be walking right behind him and nobody would go to him. So I would always go to Ty, and I would always go to the other people first because I knew I could get a lot of good one-on-one time with him because everybody was so focused on what Seth was doing and what Seth was saying. And I remember even things like, I think Patrick Waugh was being hired as the Avs coach back then.
Right.
And Seth would sit there and answer question after question about how he was going to like playing for Patrick Waugh. But he was, you know, of course, now it looks ridiculous. You know, we look back at it, but what he had to go through, I thought was crazy. And like you said, I think he bore the brunt of the negativity when he really wasn't the problem. He wasn't the reason why Halifax won those games.
Right.
You know, it was the fact that the team couldn't stop those guys.
Yeah, the whole team had trouble with them. It was they were pretty amazing, I admit.
Yeah, and they were an impressive team to watch. I mean, there's no doubt about that. You know, it's interesting now with Mike Johnson being back behind the bench, and we know the whole sanctions thing here has been beaten to death over the last year. Travis Green is gone now, and it got to the point for me, actually, following the team, where it just really seemed like Travis Green's team at some point. I didn't even... Not that I didn't think about Johnson, but it just seemed to become so much a team in Travis Green sort of style and image. Is it fair to say that the team was different, that there was a tangible difference that may have been better even than what Johnson could have done with that group? Was there something different about the way that Green had them playing? Did you see anything that you thought might have indicated that?
Oh, I don't think I ever really noticed anything with the style of play or anything. I think the assumption's always been that Johnson's always been more of the brains of the team, and Travis Green was more like the emotional center, the heart. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, there was so much going on last year. It's just so hard to separate everything out. And it's probably not something we'll know for, like, probably 5 years or so, and we'll see how Mike does without Travis, and we'll see how Travis performs in the pros.
Yeah, and I think when I say that, it makes it sound like I'm criticizing Johnson in some way, which is not the point, because it's, we know how good he's been, you know, with turning this team around. It just seemed like almost like there was a certain character or a certain behavior around the team that the players were a little more defiant and feisty, but that also could have come from the whole sanctions thing.
Yeah,
and having to take that us against the world mentality, I guess.
Yeah, there was so much going on that it's just, you can't, I don't think it's impossible to separate all that out.
Travis is gone now this year, so that's a new thing. Johnson's had him the entire time. They bring in this new coach, Carl Taylor. Johnson said, you know, today that it's different because he's got somebody who's not really as familiar with the team, familiar with the league. There's going to be some getting up to speed that he didn't have to do in years past with Travis, but he's also bringing Kyle Gustafson behind the bench full time. So you would think it's going to be fairly seamless here, but there's still going to be some things to be worked out early this year, just beyond the personnel stuff, just with the coaches.
And you know, if they get off to a slow start, people are going to say that Travis was the real reason that they had done it the last few years.
Right, right. Yeah, the way
they very well could, with everybody being gone and they've got some injury issues. They could very well get off to a slow start.
Yeah, and I wonder, the thing that, if they do get off to a slow start, it seems like, and this has been going back for 2 years now, that a certain segment of the fan base, I don't know how representative this is of everybody who follows the team, but people seem to be really worried about Brendan Burke. And it seems like if the team doesn't do well early on, that he's going to get most of the blame for that. And I don't think that's probably going to be a fair thing, unless there is something really, really obvious that he's a deficiency. But why is everybody freaking out so much about him?
Scott, it's what we do here. Matt Caruth took more guff from people than anybody over the last 3 years. And probably most of it undeserved. But, you know, it's been a question. I just found some of this talk bizarre about the nepotism aspect, him, his dad being a goalie. And, I mean, I've even heard some people saying that they cut a deal with him somehow, which I can't even figure out what benefit that would be for them. But, you know, they've protected him a lot the last 2 years, breaking him in, and he's had that great defense on him. He had a pretty good year last year, but I mean, the question now, I mean, some people have never thought much of him, and we'll just have to see. I mean, we'll get our answers this year, whether he can really be a WHL goalie.
Yeah, and he played last year mostly against you know,
right,
Everett,
right,
and Seattle, and he actually played a lot against Tri-City, which are probably the tougher games he played. So they did a pretty good job of protecting
right.
him, but now he's got to play against, you know,
yep.
the big guns and come out of that.
And that seems to be the WHL life cycle to a large degree. But, I mean, the team is pretty loaded at forward, at least. You know, it is worrying. You need a goalie in this case to just be average, I think. And then with the forwards they have, that they should contend.
Yeah, I would think that the record they set last year of fewest goals allowed is probably not going to be threatened this year. Between a new starting goalie and then a defense that's kind of retooled, I think, to say the least. Pouliot probably won't be back until the middle of October at least. And then you're basically asking Josh Hansen and the two new guys, Garrett Haar and Anton Cederholm, to hold down the fort with some other guys who have a lot less experience filling in. Are you worried that this is going to go bad, or do you think that this ship will be righted quickly and it won't be a concern this year?
Well, it's hard to say. Definitely on paper, this is the weakest the Defense Corps has been since Mike's first season. Now, a lot of the things they've done the past few years have been a result of having a defense they could count on. So, yeah, it's going to be tough. It's interesting that they brought in a lot of older defensemen, but defensemen who've never played in the league before, Haar and Cederholm. But, I mean, they're both NHL draft picks, so they should be okay pretty much. And then they've got a few young guys behind them. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, it's definitely, if they don't contend, that's probably where you're going to, defense and goaltender is probably going to be where you end up pointing the finger.
Yeah, and they actually have kind of a logjam of defensemen, with sort of a second tier of guys that are all competing for spots. I was told today that Jordan Davies has been sent home, but that leaves guys like Zach Patterson and Justin Greer, and we still don't exactly know what's going on with Lane Viveros, if he's going to be part of the plan going forward. Seems like Sean McPherson is part of the plan. Seems like he is probably going to get more time this year. It can't bode well for a guy like Viveros, though, that McPherson was brought in the middle of last season and Viveros was set down. So I'm not sure where he fits in, even though he's been here for 3 years.
Yeah, he's spent so much time in the stands. And really, he's up to 18 now, and it's really still hard to tell how good he really is. And it's a little bit... You worry a little bit that same thing is going to happen to guys like Davies and Patterson, that they've got so many, but they got so many older players ahead of them that they're going to be sitting out and they'll be 18 and we won't know if they can really play or not. That's a worry I've had.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it's nice to have a lot of options, but like you're saying, if they don't get a chance to play until they're 18 in WHL, that doesn't necessarily bode well for their readiness to make it. I know that, and I'm not sure exactly if Greer maybe has a chance to stick around at least for the beginning of the year as a 16-year-old, but you basically your only two 16-year-olds are going to be Teixeira and Ethan Price, and with Price he seems like a pretty promising kid, but there's so many forwards with experience. I'm not even sure that he gets a whole lot of playing time, even though he looks like he could be a pretty good player.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be what they've done with a lot of other 16-year-olds, to get them the 40 games and probably fourth line minutes or so. And for Patterson and Teixeira, I mean there'll be some room for with Pouliot not coming in yet, and then when presumably he goes to the World Juniors, there'll be some space for him there.
So who do you think joins Patan and Leipzig this year on that top line? Because the easy answer would say, oh, just slide Bjorkstrand up there. But I'm not sure that that's what they're going to do. Do you have any thoughts on what they might do there?
Well, I know the first few games they tried Alex Schoenborn, which would be great if he was good enough, if he proved to be good enough to do that. That would be like found money.
Schoenborn only played 20 games last year, I think.
Right, and he was hurt most of the time and sat out a lot. He wasn't hurt. In fact, I believe they sent him down to Wenatchee for a month or so.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
But I mean, when he came in, he was supposedly around the level of where Iverson and Turgeon and Bittner were. But he didn't quite progress as much. Plus, he's a year older. But I mean, if they could slide him in there and he was able to perform, that would be amazing, because I mean they're pretty much loaded even without him. But I mean, other than that, there are other choices. I've heard McColgan maybe, then they could always go back to Bjorkstrand.
You would think that when McColgan's healthy, he would have to be a top six forward, because you just don't see McColgan playing on a third line. You know, he's just not that kind of player. So, maybe a guy like Shane Bourne is the placeholder until McColgan gets back, and then Shane Bourne can go back to a third line. But we saw last year, you know, when Ratty and was gone, that Paul Bittner had a stretch of, 10 points in 5 games playing with Patan at Leipzig. So it's probably one of those things where if you just slide anybody into there, they probably look a lot better.
Yeah, they don't have to worry. They got plenty of choices for line matchups, for sure.
Speaking of Shane McColgan, he's been, I wouldn't say he's been the most popular guy in Portland as far as the opposing player goes. And it's been, last year, the Winter Hawks were a team completely made up of players who had never played for any other WHL team. Every player on the team last year only had played for Portland in the WHL. And now you have a guy like McColgan coming in, who was a rival type. Is he going to be tough for Hawk fans to warm up to?
Oh, I don't think so. As long as he puts up about a point a game, which he's done all through his career, I think they'll be fine with him. I don't get the sense. I think I remembered one Kelowna series, people had issues with some embellishment or something. It might not even have been him, but I don't think he was ever really hated at the level of, Forsberg from Seattle or Kyle Beach or something. I don't think he was ever really... I think he was just a good player on a rival in a playoff series.
I think actually one of the series, Portland played Kelowna 2 years in a row. I think one of the series, McColgan played very well. And one of the series, he was kind of missing almost, it seemed.
I think the year it went 6 games, the first of those two, I think he played really well. And then the year they swept Kelowna, I don't think he played that well.
Yeah. One of the things that comes up in Portland a lot these days, especially with the sanctions last year, and this comes up to some extent with all the U.S. teams, but especially in Portland, is this idea that it can be a wide range of opinions, whether it's a mass conspiracy or just maybe a subconscious sort of disdain from the league for teams like Portland or teams in the U.S. doing well, and there's all these theories out there that they're trying to keep the Winter Hawks down, that kind of thing. How much do you buy into that being even remotely possible, and to what extent?
I think usually that's used in the context of the referees, and I don't put a lot of stock in it.
Right.
I think usually it's just an excuse for why the referee is biased against your team, and I generally don't buy that. I do think there's a little bit, I think it's just a business thing. It's hard to do business both in Canada and the U.S. I think in the early years when Brian Shaw brought down, there was a lot more, they pretty much needed the U.S. a little bit, at least the Portland teams and stuff. So they were a lot more accommodating. Then I get the feeling that just from a business standpoint, like with the sponsors and stuff, that they need to be a lot less accommodating. But I don't think there's a real bias. I just think from a business standpoint, it's just a little more difficult to do business involved. And it's basically a Canadian league. And I think the people running it now are more focused on Canada. And the U.S. is just a little bit of an afterthought, but I don't think it's much of a bias.
Yeah, I think afterthought is probably the right...
Yeah.
More of the accurate term there. I think, it became a lot more evident, or at least outwardly evident, when they brought up this European goalie ban thing, that there was some sort of motivation from, actually from Hockey Canada making a decision about the CHL that was meant to, even if we think it's completely... a misguided decision, their intent was to somehow improve the Canadian World Junior team standing somehow by doing this. And to those of us in the U.S. following the league, in most ways, we don't really care if Canada has a good World Junior team or not. I mean, we follow those guys when they're from the teams that we follow, but that kind of struck me as sort of a we don't care about the U.S. move kind of thing. And what's going to prevent them from saying later on that we're going to limit the number of American players can be in the league because they don't want American players developing in this league to then beat Canada in the World Junior Tournament?
It's possible. I think with this Euro goalie thing, I think they're just grasping at straws.
Yeah, I'm not really sure that it's... I mean, I agree with you. I don't think it's the right way to go about things, but...
I kind of see their perspective, but I think that's a really radical. I don't think they're anywhere near to the point where that's so bad that they needed to do that. I think it's just a really radical solution. I mean, if they pick some of the right goalies, I think is their bigger problem.
Well, that's what I was gonna say. I think it's more of a choice thing than it is a. Because what does it matter if there's 4 or 5 or 6 more goalies playing in the WHL or in the CHL for Canada when you're only going to be using 2 or 3 in the World Junior Tournament? And they didn't. I remember when this happened. I said, they didn't even invite Calvin Pickard to camp.
That's the obvious one. Yeah.
So it's like, well, if you don't know who you're going to be picking, like, it's not like they lack for depth if you can't even get a spot. So for the division, I've been trying to figure this out, and it seems like a kind of a confusing division once you get past, because it seems like the Winterhawks should win the division again and should be, a top two team in the conference. Beyond that, I'm not exactly sure what to think of any of these teams below Portland. I could see really any of the teams other than that. I don't know if Seattle would be maybe a second place team yet in the division, but any of the other three teams, it seems like they could still be pretty good. And Everett seems to be kind of the wild card this year. Do you have any thoughts on and where you think the division might be going this year and who might take a step forward, who might take a step back?
Well, I think Portland at this point is clearly number one. I think they've got the best 19-year-olds, and they're loaded at 18-year-olds. And I mean, that's the core of your team usually. So I think right now Portland is clearly above the rest. Yeah, I Everett, Seattle, Tri-Cities, I think really it could be any of those three. Odds are one of them is really going to move up. But all three of them look solid for me. And Spokane, I think, is a little bit, just on paper at least, Spokane looks to be a notch below. Everett is really interesting because, of course, they made the coaching change. And then they have all these decisions with their 20-year-olds, and they have 3 Euros, all of them who look pretty impressive. And then they have a group of 17s that they seem to be loaded at too. So they might be a year off. But I mean, then again, they could end up doing a Portland. Gary Davidson's seen it before. They could do a Portland and just gel all together at once. So
well, you don't want to say you don't want to overreact from the preseason,
right?
But
right. I was looking at their preseason scoring, and Monraj Hare is averaging 2 points a game, and
yeah.
he might even be squeezed out in the overage situation.
Right.
Braden Lowe has 9 points in 6 games, and I think he had 6 points all of last season. So, yeah, you take it with a grain of salt. I think their circumstances really benefited them in the exhibition season. And Portland played their top group the first 2 games, and then pretty much rested them when they played Everett, and then they didn't have as many people away during the Tri-Cities tournament, and I think circumstances have helped them. But I mean, I think they're really compelling to watch right now, just because they could be really good.
Well, and Austin Lotz, I would argue, and we've seen Austin Lotz play against Portland, and we've seen Eric Comrie play against Portland, that I would argue that Lotz has looked much better to me than Comrie in those games. Now, that's not to say that Comrie's not a better goaltender overall, but Lotz to me seems to be the guy that everybody overlooks as far as really good goalies, even maybe in the entire league right now.
Yeah, that's a big call with Comrie. I think Comrie just happened to – he's had some bad games against Portland. But, no, I understand where you're going. Yeah, I think he's solid. Lots. Yeah, I don't think they have any real issues there. Any more than, like, Burke or he's probably kind of in the same boat as Burke, ready to step up. He's a little more experienced.
I know. I found out today that they're going to be raising 6 banners on Friday night here. In the banner ceremony.
Yeah, I was remembering the year they won the Memorial Cup, and I only remember like 4, if even that. I was trying to think through my head what all those banners were.
Well, so I guess one of them is going to be for WHL champions, one for the for the Western Conference, one for the U.S. Division, one for winning the Scotty Munro Trophy. That's 4, right?
That's 4.
They said that they're going to raise a banner that commemorates every Memorial Cup appearance. So it's going to have every year that they've been in the Memorial Cup. It's going to be a separate banner, I guess. So, and then I don't know what the 6th one is. I can't remember. I don't know what else there would be, but...
Yeah, I was scratching my head trying to think that through.
I didn't know if each player on the team was going to get their own banner.
Yeah, it could be.
And then I said, well, you're going to be able to, since they play all their games for the next, month and a half at the former Rose Garden, the Moda Center. I said, well, you're going to be able to keep these banners up because you're going to raise them, right? And then normally they would just go over to the Coliseum and you're not going to be playing there for 6 weeks or something like that. So they think they're going to be able to keep them up for a while through some of the first few games so people can actually, look at them. Early in the season.
Probably until the Trailblazers...
until the Blazers come in
Trailblazers,
and kick everything
Trailblazers
out.
Appear, and then they'll scrub out any sign of existence.
What were your opinions when you heard the talk that Paul Allen was actually interested at one point in bringing in the NHL here a couple months ago? What would your reaction be to if that actually were to happen? Are you the kind of guy that would welcome the NHL, or do you like what we have here right now?
I like what we have here. I think it would be great if we could have both, and that's why you'd like to see the Coliseum renovation all get the I's dotted and T's crossed. So as long as it didn't hurt junior hockey here, I would be fine with the NHL, but...
Yeah, they have to do something with the Coliseum here at some point.
Right, yeah.
And
they've needed to do something with it for a long time. It's just been so much red tape. But
they did put new ice in, so we actually we do actually have a regulation-sized rink now in there.
Yep, very much needed, and worked very well last year.
Apparently you can't walk from... I was told that a couple of years ago when Brennan Yudlowski of Everett took a trip over to the Portland locker room that he couldn't do so he had to take his skates off in order to get over there. He couldn't walk with his skates on the concrete all the way over to the other dressing room. So that's one thing they got to fix.
Yeah. Well, and when there's a big crowd, the concourse just gets so filled. I can't imagine how the Trailblazers ever survived as long as they did there.
Yeah, in a full
selling out every night. And
I think getting back to this past year versus maybe the previous two, and that was, it seemed like we had less of, because a couple years there, a guy like Brad Ross, for instance, would have a tendency to float out of the defensive zone, look for the home run pass, that kind of thing. Seemed like that kind of thing kind of went away last year, and there was more commitment from the forwards to take care of their own end, back check, all those kinds of things, more than I'd ever seen in the past. I wondered if that was a tactical change, or if it was just finally getting them to all buy into that they all needed to do that in order to be successful.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it was a special group. It was really a special group. So I wouldn't be surprised if they figured it out on their own.
Yeah, because everybody talks about, Patan, for instance, the offensive skills he has, but the things he does in his own end are almost as impressive sometimes, and you see the highest, you see the top scorers are the ones usually killing the penalties too.
Patan for me was the MVP of the league last year. I don't even think Portland nominated him. I think Portland nominated Leipzig from what I heard, but I think they owe Patan that Scotty Monroe trophy because that stretch in December where they were missing all those players at the World, and then I think they had a couple of players hurt, and it just seemed like he took over some of those games that they really probably shouldn't have expected to win all of them, and I think they did win all of them, and I think that put him over the top to finish with the best record overall. So I think he was as much as anybody responsible for that.
Yeah, and that was almost like a preview for some of the things they're going through this year because
right.
they didn't have Ratty, Jones, Weatherspoon for an extended period of time, and they won every game anyway. Obviously, you still had Carruth and Rutkowski and Peters then, but three of your best players were gone. They still won games, so in a sense, it's like a preview for what they're going to be going through now, missing those three guys.
No, I could really see them having to count a lot on Patan this first few weeks with everybody out. So it was good to see, well, not good for him, I guess, but it's good for the team, their early record, I guess, for him to, I guess he was sent back today.
Yes. And I think they expect everybody else to be back in the next couple of days, other than Pouliot, who will be gone for probably till the middle of October.
Yeah, they will miss him a great deal. It's hard to see where the offense is going to come from the defense and the defensemen. Because we just don't know a lot about Haar and Cederholm. So it's hard to tell right now how much offense they'll provide.
Would you agree with the notion that Pouliot is the single most important player on this team?
Yeah, I could see that. Because they need offense from their back line. Either him or Burke. I think Pouliot's the only returning player in the whole league, maybe just the conference. But I think the whole league, the only defenseman who averaged over a point a game.
Yeah, and you're right.
I don't know that.
Yeah,
go
ahead.
Have you heard anything? They're still expecting him to come back. They don't think he's going to stick with the Penguins, do they?
No. The expectation is that he'll be back, yes.
Right.
Johnson said that there's a possibility if he really plays well, that he could get into the regular season. But I don't think there's really any danger right now of him playing full time there. I do think that they are. As soon as they gave Ethan Price number three, that was pretty much a indication that they don't expect Seth Jones back.
Not a big shock.
Although I did say that if Price requested number three, and so I said, well, you know, if Seth comes back, then you know, if something goes weird and Seth comes back, then you really have to take him to the cleaners on how much you're going to charge him for the number back. I guess Price's other number is 33, which is being wearing my Shammerhorn. So,
yeah, that surprised me a little bit that they were keeping him as the backup instead of Hill. But I think it was 50-50 either way.
Yeah, I'm guessing that it probably came down to just age and experience
a
little bit.
He's 18, Hill is 17. Pretty much both of them really need to start playing, so I don't know what they're going to do there.
It does sound like Dominic Turgeon is out.
Yeah, I saw that.
For about 3 weeks now. He has a crack in a bone above his ankle. So he has to, recover from that. So I don't think he was even practicing today. I don't remember if he was out there. McColgan was skating today, but still a few weeks away. And I guess Mahan's a few weeks away, too, so there's three forwards that they have to replace, at least for the time being.
Well, at the very least, it'll help them make some more decisions on some of the kids.
I want to go back to this goes back to the Brendan Burke hysteria. The dumbest thing I think I read last year regarding the Winter Hawks was the people who wanted to keep both Carruth and Cam Lanigan and then get rid of either Rutkowski or Peters.
Well,
that might have been the dumbest thing I read. I don't know if it was the top thing, but it was way up there because people were so worried about Brendan Burke. that they wanted to keep a guy in Lanigan, a 20-year-old goalie, a 20-year-old backup goalie who had like a career 875 save percentage.
I think in general most fan bases aren't really good judges of goalies, and I think our fan base is probably a little bit even more bizarre on that.
I have to admit, I don't read the fan discussion from other teams as closely. I'm sure there are just as ridiculous things being thrown out for any team's fans, but it's always interesting, kind of funny to me to read some of the things. Some of the panic. There's always the panic moves, you know, that people want to make, and to me that was like the ultimate panic move.
Yeah.
And Lanigan, he had an okay season in Medicine Hat. So,
but good season, I think.
And it was good for him to go there and play. And
he was one of the main reasons they took out Saskatoon, I think, in the first round. Okay.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right.
Thanks.
Have a good
one. Bye-bye. Thanks again to Dylan for being my guest. You can follow him on Twitter at DylanDB. That's at DylanDB. You can also read his work at OregonLive.com/Hawks. While you're there, you can read what I'm writing about the Winter Hawks these days. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time on the podcast.